Hello, and welcome to Making the Museum. I'm Jonathan Alger, and this is a project of C&G Partners, Design for Culture. Today, I am joined by Roger Chang. Roger, welcome to the show.
It's nice to be here, Jonathan.
So to get started, for those who don't know you like I know you, could you tell our listeners who you are and what you do?
So I'm a mechanical engineer by training, and I am currently a Washington, D.C. based and office leader for B.R. Happel. We're a multidisciplinary international design firm that focuses on museums and performing arts centers, a lot of institutional work all over the country and the world.
Great. And could you tell our dear listener how you got into that business? See, a lot of times when I ask that question, like, what's your origin story? The answer is kind of a crazy and wonderful, dramatic, sideways move. I'm guessing that in your case, it might have been a little more linear because you are practicing a field that you actually can study in school. So say a little bit more about how you ended up doing what you're doing.
Sure. I'm definitely very fortunate to have found this aspect of our field. Growing up, I knew I wanted to be in some sort of design field, but I didn't think I had quite the artistic skill to be an architect. But when I was at MIT, my sophomore year, I came upon a professor that was doing research on air quality in ice rinks. Pretty niche-y. But for some reason, something drew me to that topic. I was learning to ice skate at the time. I contacted this professor, Professor Qinyan Chen, and he said, oh, you seem like you'd be a perfect fit to help me with research. And so what am I going to work on? I said, well, I'm working on all these computational models to study airflow in different types of spaces. And my current research is on air quality in ice rinks. So I ended up going to ice rinks all over the Boston area and taking measurements of temperature, humidity, carbon monoxide, air velocity. And this is all to help calibrate and test computational models that were designed to run a much more limited computing power over 20 years ago. This is before we had the cloud, but it was so important to be able to understand how a system might work before actually building the system. And the reason the focus on ice rinks is because most of them use Zamboni machines that ran on propane at the time. So there's like running a car inside a confined space. And ice makes air heavier, and so all these products of combustion would just sit in a space and not be very good for air quality. So from that moment, I started to see there's this whole building science and technology part to architecture. I continued on and studied advanced facades, and then in my first job in New York City, I was really grateful to be able to work on a range of museum projects. Mostly new construction, additions like to the Cleveland Museum of Art and a renovation to Philadelphia Museum of Art. But I really got this exposure to how powerful and important integrated engineering is to creating a museum environment. I was hooked from then and continued in my career to focus quite a bit on cultural projects.
Now at this point, some of our dear listeners, some percentage of them, are now wondering, do you still ice skate?
Do, but not that well. I can probably ski better than I can ice skate. So I'm glad I didn't turn that into a career in some way.
Okay, good for you. I'm not going to do it, but you just gave me the only opportunity I've ever had in a formal situation to tell my one Zamboni joke. I actually have one. Maybe I'll do that later. But anyway, let's get into your list for today, which is fascinating to me. And I've seen you talk about these subjects, and we are working on a project right now together, and we have worked on projects before, and I just find this all fascinating, partly because there are some assumptions in the fundamental way that we approach any museum project and any exhibition project that you are in a unique position to address, and you have some thoughts about it that are a little out of the ordinary compared to what people might assume. So we're going to be talking today with Roger Chang, about some new ideas in museum climate control. As always, I have the list and my guest has the rest. Today we have 8 points on the list. If you would like to keep track, we'll do 4 of them, a little halftime show, and then our last 4 if you're walking a dog and you're not sure what the heck we're up to here. So point number 1 is a doozy, and it's simply, why 70 degrees? And I think that points to, you know, the old classic, the assumption that museums have to have a certain stable temperature at a certain level, a certain stable humidity at a certain level, and that's how everything has to be designed to be a museum in good standing. And I think you're asking the question, why? So let's talk about that. What do you think? Why does it have to be 70 degrees? I guess what you're saying is maybe it doesn't have to be?
That's right. Well, this started out over 40 years ago. There was a gentleman named Gary Thompson who wrote a book called The Museum Environment, and it became a primer that's heavily referenced within the museum world. And he initially suggested that 70 degrees Fahrenheit, 50% relative humidity was a wonderful place to start for an environment. But he also wrote hundreds of other pages that said you don't necessarily need that for every single piece that would go in a collection. You also have to make sure you can maintain that reliably over the course of the lifespan of your facility. But somehow the 70 and the 50 got shorthanded and it stuck. We also add even more constraints to it. We want plus or minus 2 degrees Fahrenheit typically, and plus or minus 5% relative humidity. But how do we maintain that? That requires a lot of things to happen, from a good, strong building enclosure that can control heat transfer and air movement and water vapor movement. It also requires a really robust HVAC system. And it also requires a good operating team, an operating team that has enough resources to be able to run that system, keep it in good shape, change filters, keep valves operating, all those good things like we see in even our own personal home. And a lot of museums do have financial constraints to be able to maintain that sustainability. And there's also this other layer related to energy use and resource use. Museums typically use about 4 to 5 times the intensity of energy as, let's say, an office building. And so when we think about that, that can start to really impact, especially for a smaller institution, their overall operating and financial model.
So I want to back up a minute on some of the things you just said. For one thing, I think even your first point is, I don't know, maybe it's just me, but I'm really got me thinking. So first of all, I'd like to do a little jargon alert for our dear listener. HVAC, you use that word. I know what it means. You know what it means. Let's make sure we define that for our listener.
Definitely.
What's your definition of that, of that word, so they understand?
Yeah, heating, ventilation, and air conditioning. So all the things that keep a building warm when it's cold outside, dry and cool during the summer, and then also bring in fresh air for people so we don't asphyxiate them. So
right. Well, we wouldn't want to do that.
Yeah. So that system definitely creates an environment not only for a collection, but also for people at the same time.
For sure. So, and going back to these big sacred numbers that we hear about all the time, as you pointed out, Gary Thompson said it would be nice to be 70 degrees Fahrenheit and 50% humidity, but you know, that's not necessarily some kind of golden rule. And now it is, despite what he wrote, which is interesting. Go back and do the research, find out what they really said. But that means that now we've got 70 degrees Fahrenheit plus or minus 2 degrees Fahrenheit as sort of our temperature standard. I just want the listener to understand that means you need to have a very powerful, as Rogers defined it, HVAC system to make sure as it gets warmer, you keep it cool, and as it gets cooler, you keep it warm. And the same thing with humidity, which is maybe even harder to control. That
definitely,
you know, if 50% relative humidity is like, that's not like a desert in terms of humidity, and it's not like a rainforest in terms of humidity, one being very dry, the other being very, very moist, but right in between. And trying to keep that from varying much is also very challenging. You have to have a very expensive system. And I think a lot of listeners are now be sort of amazed by the what you just said, that museums use 4 or 5 times the energy per square foot of a skyscraper or a residential building or something like that. That's kind of amazing, especially as we think everyone who listens to this show is thinking about climate, I'm sure, and just the idea that to keep things cool, we have to burn out of fossil fuels. I'm not going to illustrate every point you say the way that I just did, but I think some of that is really important to keep in our minds so that you can now question it. When you tell people, does it need to be 70 degrees, or here's what Gary Thompson really wrote, what do people say?
There's a huge range of museums we see out there, interpretive museums that are very exhibit focused to ones that showcase fine art. And every type of object has a different requirement. The thing that we're trying to control against is deterioration, and that can happen in a lot of different ways. There's a mechanical stress to a object that's just, it's under tension as the temperature or humidity changes, especially if it happens really quickly. It can cause fracture and cracking. But we also want to control, most of all, chemical degradation. And just like we put food in a refrigerator to slow spoiling, we can do the same thing for organic objects, for art objects. The cooler that object is kept, slightly drier than that 50% relative humidity, it extends its life. Now, when we talk about extending life, we're talking about maybe 50 years, 100 years. In a public setting, it's hard to keep that space as cool as maybe that art actually wants to be, because people don't want to be too cold in a space. So there is this tension between thermal comfort and collection stewardship. In a lot of cases, art actually wants to be in a storage facility without any light, in a very calm and controlled environment. But then how do we access it and look at it? And that's where digitization, the way we interact with art in self, is a really fascinating topic.
So you're doing what you do, you're kind of right at the middle of the kind of the museum paradox, which is we want to preserve the things for future generations to see, but as soon as we bring them out for people to see, we are no longer preserving them, right?
That's right.
You just mentioned art wants to be somewhere cooler than people. Is the 70 degrees, is that as cold as it needs to get for art, but it's a little too cold for people? Or does art actually want it to be even colder than that? It's interesting what you just said, like the art and the people actually want a different temperature. Now what do we do?
That's right. Yeah, actually some types of art, let's say film, if any of us know what that is still, wants to be in a freezer. So even like below 32 degrees Fahrenheit, but some paper objects prefer 60 degrees, but we would never be able to tolerate that in a museum environment unless we do have everyone wear a jacket. And then that becomes extremely tough on the building itself. And you basically have to build a refrigerator to create that condition. And that becomes very, very challenging to do at scale. And so collection storage facilities are very different in terms of how you put things in the space. It's all about density, while in a public gallery, it's all about access for people and giving enough room for people to contemplate and look at a piece of art.
When I was a kid, I lived on a farm and we had a root cellar, which was in the lower level of the house. It was dug into the earth and it was always kind of uncomfortably cold there, but always the same temperature. So it seems like the kind of phenomenon you're talking about.
It definitely is.
I guess if we want to have a museum of film where we store all of our film, we just put it in the Arctic Circle and that's how we
exactly
have less, use less energy to keep it cool. Wow. Okay. So there's a lot of things. But again, what fascinates me here is that these are the kinds of things you're thinking about that fundamentally dictate what a museum is, how it's built, and how much it costs, and how much it costs to run it. But you're thinking about that most people take for granted, and that's fascinating. So that was all just point number one. Point number two, your point, does it have to be the premier system? Number two, does it have to be the premier system? And maybe that goes back to what Gary Thompson said, which is, you know, you want your 70 plus or minus two and your 50 plus or minus five if you can get it, but maybe you can't get it, so that's okay. Or where are you going with that? Are we shocking the world by asking this question?
Well, there's amazingly a lot of wonderful discussion on this topic already because of the sensitivity to sustainability and using resources well. And I think a lot of institutions have started with what is considered a gold standard and found that they run into challenges maintaining that longer term. You don't have to maintain that condition, let's say, for an entire building, because if you just have one object that needs that tighter condition, perhaps you have that art in a special climate control case, and then you can have a more relaxed condition in the rest of the space. So a lot of what's happening in industry is more about just right-sizing and having discussions on these frameworks at early point in a design process, and then really understand what is going to be in the collection, both today, but also longer term. That flexibility consideration tends to be what drives this level of stringency, because we are trying to forecast something that might be a little bit unknown in the future, and an institution doesn't want to have their hands tied in the future in loaning a particular object from the Smithsonian or a museum overseas. And a lot of this is really bound by loan agreements, which are maybe not that standardized right now. And so that makes people design things in a more conservative way. And so I've been a big proponent really about education on this topic, because I think the more people know, the more there will be comfort in at least right sizing. It's not that every object shouldn't have these conditions, but that we can consider it in a more careful and early in a process.
Wow. I just love the idea of just even opening up the subject and considering it, rather than kind of saying, you know, these are our commandments, you know, ye shall live by it. More it's like, hey, Roger, what do you think of them? And Roger says, you know, ye shall rewrite them. That's super interesting. So your next point is going to be about loan agreements. But before we do that, I have a question. You just mentioned a scenario where you could design an entire museum and its storage facilities and its exhibitions of whatever kind in a less expensive and less, you know, in a way that's better for the climate overall, if you could isolate certain objects and give them a more stringent environment while allowing everything else to have a different environment. So my question is, the implication there is, okay, we've just got a few things we're going to put on display and they need to be in 60 degree temperature, or they need to be, there's some pieces of film and they need to be in a refrigerated case or something like that. What's your take on the wisdom of having a case, an individual space that's small on display that has its own HVAC system? There are pros and cons to that, like what happens when it breaks, but what's your position on that, or what's your thinking on that, and have you seen that succeed and have you seen it fail? And then we'll get to the next point.
So we've seen a lot of use of what are passive cases. So these cases just use a silica type product. It can absorb moisture, and then you can remove this and essentially reheat it. And so the moisture evaporates off, and then you can preload that back into the casework. And that's really been the kind of direction we've seen institutions take more, because it's still a passive type of approach. There's not like this large mechanical system that's requiring special components that could fail. And we have worked with some museums that do have those type of active systems. They have their own separate mechanical system, and it supplies a little bit of cool and dry air directly to the case, but they are definitely a bit more finicky. They do have components that are a bit more rare that if they do break, you may not have somebody who can maintain or repair that piece of equipment.
And also, if it breaks on the weekend and it's a holiday weekend and it's, you know, and you can't get into the museum because there's a flood or whatever, suddenly you have this huge change in humidity, which, as you said, like the sudden change is what can create the cracks in the painting you just described.
Yeah, it's a sudden change that causes the most risk. And a lot of frameworks for environmental control in museums classify based on the tightness of the temperature and humidity. And there's different letter grades within one particular framework that we use in the United States, from a double A, which is the most stringent, to even to a D. But there's nothing necessarily wrong with any of them. It's that there's an appropriate application for each one. But going from that top grade just to the next one opens up so many opportunities. We've seen from our own analysis that going down one step, you can potentially open the opportunity to reduce your energy use by 50%. And so that top
tier. In one step.
Yeah. So that one step is tremendous impact, but that top step still aligns with that 70 and 50 that we started our discussion with.
So double A is the 70-50 quote unquote gold standard. But if you're willing to go to single A,
right?
If you're like, you have to study really hard to get an A+. If you're willing to get an A, you can study, and that's probably true, right? Like it's, you know, you could study half as much and get an A, but like that last, you know, 3%, you have to double your effort.
That's right. Yeah. So there's definitely like this kind of exponential effort and system requirement. And it's very much driven by where a museum is located. So the thing we're trying to moderate against is the outdoor climate. So if we have something in a climate like in Washington, D.C., it's extremely challenging because we have pretty hot and humid days, but also still gets pretty cold. And so the environment can only really be as good as the system, but also that building enclosure. Just like we can go to the store and buy, you know, a huge range of different types of jackets that have different waterproof coatings, different insulation. We approach this with buildings in that way too.
Wow, that's amazing. Going from a double A to an A, you can, wow. That, I think if people are listening carefully to what you're saying right now and taking a couple of good notes, you might have just saved someone $1 million. And I think that's the idea, right? You're all about education, and that's what we're doing here. We're trying to get this word out to people because I think some of these things you're saying are really just so incredibly important. I did promise you your third point, though. Number three, reconsider those loan agreements. In my practice, obviously, we're not handling the mechanical, electrical, plumbing system directly hands-on. We're working with you when you do that. But we are working with our clients on the subject of loan agreements. We're often designing exhibitions or experiences where that's an issue. When's the object going to come? Will it come? Do we need to have a backup? What kind of environment will it need? What's written in the loan agreements? And as you said, they're often different. There's no standard. You hinted at that before. What's been your experience? And when you say reconsider the loan agreements, in what way?
I think it's to use more consistent terminology and reference like the standard, like the letter grades that I mentioned. In a session that we had at the Building Museums Conference last year, we had a panelist from a local museum dig into 7 years of their loan agreements, and they found that there was a huge range of formats and terminology, different temperatures and humidities, some things that maybe weren't even realistic in their targets, and other things that were very loose from statements like, you shall maintain a good environment, right? No numbers associated with it, but completely qualitative and in nature. And so I think that forces the industry to end up being quite conservative when they approach loan agreements and borrowing art from another collection. I think if there is a more standardized format, pre-vetted, it will really help, I think, both ends feel more comfortable with how they set up their systems. Now, ultimately, if a museum does decide to have a space, maybe an individual gallery that can maintain that tight condition, doesn't mean they necessarily need to operate it at that. And that's what we try to encourage the operational side of a museum system is maybe one day it's running at a wider band because it's showing something that can tolerate it. And then when you do have that blockbuster exhibit, where you're loaning something from the Louvre and it's a super sensitive collection, you can run it just for that one exhibit. So that operational flexibility is another thing to really consider.
And right, just because your HVAC system yes, has the ability to do 70, 50, doesn't mean you have to make it do.
That's right.
Yeah, it's like in our homes, right? If we want to,
exactly. We
all know that if we live in a place where we have to have air conditioners to be comfortable, which is a lot of people these days, You can turn it up during a hot month and, you know, turn it to 80 and save a lot of money on your electric bill. Same thing like you're saying, right? Your fourth point, I know, because we were talking about this before in our sort of green room pre-show, is a personal story. And I love this story. I kind of asked you to get it in there. And I'll just announce the title. It's point number four. And I'd love you to just tell this story.
Sure.
The title, point number four, is Knitting at the Renwick, knitting as in yarn, at the Renwick as in art museum. You had a great personal moment at the Renwick involved knitting. Tell our audience about that.
Sure. Well, this is a story that when I reflect on it has such an interesting tie to my career, something super memorable. My wife is in the fiber arts field. She does a lot of design and teaching. She's taught hundreds, maybe thousands of folks how to knit all across the region. When I moved from New York with my wife to Washington, D.C., which is where I had grown up, she was rebuilding her network within the arts and crafts world. And she had the opportunity to fill in for somebody to teach a workshop at the Renwick Gallery. And the Renwick Gallery has an amazing history. It's the Smithsonian's Arts and Crafts Museum, originally built in 1863, designed by James Renwick. It's often known as the American Louvre. And even though I grew up in the Washington, D.C. area, I had never gone to this museum before. It's not on the National Mall. It's next to the Blair House, about a block away from the White House. But if you look at it, before it went through a major renovation, it often looked close. It was a bit imposing. The signage maybe wasn't as strong as it should have been. But I had this opportunity to go with my wife when she was teaching this workshop, went into this building, and was really struck by its architecture. It's a building that has two main exhibition floors, 20-foot vaulted ceilings. And at the rear of the building, on the second floor, is what's known as the Grand Salon. It's about 5,000 square foot space, 40-foot ceilings, and with art hung salon style. So just like you would see masterworks shown in the Louvre and other great European museums, this is kind of a mini version of that in the center of Washington, D.C. And I remember leaving the museum that day with an impression of this museum that's very powerful, telling my wife, gosh, it'd be cool to work on this building someday. And I remember she told me, oh, maybe you'll get to work on it someday. You'll find some way to make that happen. And so about a year and a half later, the request for proposal for a full modernization of the Renwick Gallery came out from the Smithsonian. And the firm I was with at the time ended up submitting a proposal. We made it to the top three firms and actually ended up winning the commission to modernize this building. And that was the start of an incredible three-year journey to design and work with a contractor to fully restore and transform this for another 100 years. And this is a project that really shaped the way I view historic and existing museums. It's a museum where it's so ingrained in cultural history, but still was a bit unknown. It is a building that almost got torn down in the 1960s. And Jackie Kennedy led what was one of the first moves of the modern historic preservation era to save this museum from being demolished for what's now the executive office building behind it. This is a museum that only had about 40,000 visitors the year before it was shut down for this modernization, which was very, very low for something in the Smithsonian portfolio. And one of the reasons for that is because it wasn't able to show exhibits that would resonate with the general public, because it needed this overhaul. It needed upgrades to its HVAC system. It needed upgrades to some of its structural systems. It just needed a refresh. And it's interesting to fast forward from 1972, when that museum was turned over back to the Smithsonian to be this Arts and Crafts Museum. You know, what could we do to do things differently than the way it was modernized 50 years before?
I love that everything comes back around to heating, ventilation, and air conditioning. even when we're talking about knitting, it comes back around. I have a feeling anything I could propose is going to come back around to HVAC, and maybe that's a good thing. Okay, let's do a quick halftime show. Here's a station identification. If you're just joining, you're listening to Making the Museum. I'm Jonathan Alger, and this is a project of C&G Partners Design for Culture. If you find this show valuable, please help spread the word. You can rate the show in Apple Podcasts or Spotify. You can also write a review in Apple Podcasts. And thank you, mille grazie, for everyone who has made this show a five-star podcast. And as I like to joke, if you have a one-star review, just take it to that other podcast. You can also just tell a friend to check out makingthemuseum.com for everything about this podcast and its sister newsletter. More on that at the end of the show. But now back to the conversation. Today, we are hearing from Roger Chang about some new ideas in museum climate control. And next up, we've done our first four. We have eight, is number five. And number five is don't fight the building. And I know I heard the extended version of that knitting at the Renwick story earlier. And I know part of how you helped them to modernize it by not fighting the building. You got pretty clever and you started to know some of the spaces in the building maybe better than other people did. Say more about how an engineer cannot fight a building.
Sure. So we'll go back to the 1860s when this building was originally constructed. We didn't have all the letters in HVAC. We didn't have the cooling part at that time. So this is a building that's very heavy masonry. It had its own, what we call thermal mass and stability inherent in that structure to help it function as what was originally the first purpose-built art museum in the United States. It's actually the original Corcoran Gallery of Art. This is a building, when they did do the renovation in 1970, before turning it over to the Smithsonian, much of the HVAC equipment was crammed into every nook and cranny, but without maybe as much sensitivity to longer-term operations and maintenance. So you barely had room to get to a unit and open it up and change the filters. Some of the equipment was in an attic space that was pretty tricky to navigate. You're just walking on wooden planks with a structure. So it wasn't really set up for longer-term maintenance. And it showed the building wasn't able to maintain the kind of temperature and humidity that Smithsonian looks for across its overall portfolio. And many of these projects, when they go into modernization, they're preceded by a master plan. And that master plan just identifies, here's generally what needs to be done. Maybe it goes through a couple of design concepts. And the master plan suggested raising the roof of this historic building by 10 feet. And so when we won the project, we worked as an integrated team to think about that differently. Is that something that really needs to be done? I'd hate for someone to associate HVAC with impacting the historic integrity of this wonderful building. And so we challenged that, and we looked at how systems were routed through the building originally in 1860. We looked at what other interventions already had happened in 1970, and we found a pretty clever solution just to put equipment in different way locations within the building rather than just in a traditional layout in a mechanical space. We just looked at it with a different set of ideas. And it was also helped by using LED lighting as well as strategically upgrading all of the windows. So we were able to reduce the peak cooling demand of this building by about 20%. And what that means is everything can be a little bit smaller. It can fit better within the space. And we were able to modernize everything to meet the Smithsonian standards while reducing energy use of the building by 50% after a reopen.
Wait a minute. I want to hold on a minute. Wait, I was about to ask you a question about the first thing you said, and then the last thing you said just completely almost erased the first question, but hang on, let me see if I can remember it. You were able to figure out clever places to put the HVAC equipment so that by doing that and by a range of other things, you could reduce cooling demand by 20%, which seems like a virtuous cycle.
That's right.
If you can demonstrate in advance that you can reduce cooling demand by 20%, you can reduce the amount of equipment and mechanisms necessary because you know you need less because you figured out a way to reduce it. So that's a virtuous cycle. And then you just said that that reduced overall energy use by 50%. Mm-hmm. So that's like what you said before, going from AA to single A, or I guess from A to B or whatever, mm-hmm. one step down, not even A to D, is a huge reduction. Did I hear that right? Did you just say 50%?
Yeah, that's right. And what's most interesting is the museum wasn't meeting B or A or AA, is because the systems didn't have a modern control system. So it was very hard to have the equipment run at its optimal state. And by being able to also help the enclosure perform a bit better, that just keeps the conditioned air where it needs to be inside the building overall.
Wow. Okay. This is a bit of a mic drop. You're just kind of saying, oh, and we reduced the energy use by 50%. Hey, are you eating that pickle? It's like, that's a heck of a big number. Everyone, please, now, immediately, hire Roger Chang. And then there will be more resources in the budget to make a bigger exhibit. No, I'm kidding. Too much coffee. That's great. That's terrific. I wanted to ask you earlier, when you were recounting that story, in my mind, I couldn't help but relate it to the earlier story you told about knitting at the Renwick and your wife reconnecting with people in D.C. and you growing up there. And you kind of having this moment, unexpected moment in this museum. Did the care and the love and the depth of analysis that you did to achieve this remarkable effect, do you think that was fueled in part or sort of powered by or made possible by that earlier moment? Like your love, like a personal sense of connection to this museum that you had kind of made your own because of this earlier moment?
Definitely. I think to work on these types of projects, they do require this care, this passion. I think this fundamental value system that what we're doing is to help preserve and support arts and crafts for another generation and multiple generations. And it's hard not to grow up in the DC area and be influenced by the Smithsonian as an entity overall. I have so many fond memories of time with my family and friends at the Air and Space Museum, History Museum, seeing the Woolly Mammoth at the Natural History Museum. And I think museums overall make such a big impact on people, whether it's in their hometown or they're just visiting a new city for the day. But I think that legacy of the story that I heard of how Jackie Kennedy helped to save this museum, now 50 years later, we had this opportunity to also ensure its legacy. What we learned during design is the museum, fast forward 50 years, there was some consideration of potentially giving the Renwick Gallery back to the federal government because its attendance had gone so low, because they weren't able to showcase the kind of exhibits that a modern audience requires. And all those things, I think for not just myself, but the entire team, design team, the owner, the contractor that worked on the project, you do have to care. And it does require applying a lot of brain power and skill, not just individual skill, but collective team skill to do this type of work.
That Woolly Mammoth you mentioned probably needs a lot of HVAC. But I've noticed in all my conversation I've always had with you, you're coming from an engineering background, but you're talking about Jackie Kennedy and you're talking about, how to refrigerate film stock for preservation. And you're talking about the chemical composition of oil paintings. And I don't know if every engineer in the world is into that kind of thing, or if that's it's because of how you, growing up in the Smithsonian or whatever, but it sounds like you view all of that as a perk of your job, not a duty of your job. Do I have that right? Like for you, it's fun to have to know that and to speak about that.
It definitely is. And I think we're going to talk about fun puzzles. And it's definitely something that when we work on the most challenging topic, I do talk to my team and say, well, get ready for this fun puzzle. And it's because we do want to have fun, but sometimes we start that puzzle wondering, gosh, is there a solution? Are we going to be able to get through this? And so it does take a bit of grit and determination. And I can't overemphasize just that collaboration to help get these things done. And I do think back to the Grand Salon and thinking of my wife teaching there, because she's part of the legacy and a small part of this museum, just like the millions and millions of people who've gone through this museum over its history. Actually, during the Civil War, it was used in a totally different function. So even this building has an interesting history, not only as a museum, but just as a public federal facility. I think when we think about the impact these museums can have longer term, it helps teams persevere and try to think as creatively as possible. And I think the puzzle that we unlocked in this case was being able to look not at traditional ways of how space lays out, but to go up, down, left, right, look in all dimensions. Think of it in terms of a Jenga puzzle where you're really optimizing space as much as possible.
Right. I think that kind of combines, I think you're combining two of your points. I mean, point number six is about fun puzzles. And it sounds like you're someone who likes to solve fun puzzles. Point number seven, look in all directions. And I think we kind of talked about look in all directions earlier by you figuring out other places to put the HVAC systems for the Renwick, right? The fun puzzles, I guess, goes to, what goes into choosing to be an engineer and being interested in solving things that are complicated. I've felt in my practice that I'm kind of drawn, maybe not necessarily always to my advantage, to problems that are hairy, difficult, challenging. Right. Part of the benefit of doing what we do is actually to get to solve things that are impossible, which I'm not sure that everybody would agree is a good reason to do something. Do you agree with that? Is that native to your profession, or is that native to you?
I would say it's native to our profession, especially, I would say, the cultural sector, because we know that these museums are ones that one day we might bring a family member or a friend to visit. And so I think there's a sense of pride that comes full circle with the investment that we put in. And I think that's something to have for not only the Smithsonian, but any institution of any scale, because they're museums, because they have a public mission to educate, to take care of some form of collection. I think there's thousands and thousands of museums just in the United States alone with a varied content, all the way from, you know, Pez containers to the finest works of art. And I think because we can relate in many cases to the things that are in these museums, that makes it just more powerful, the work that we do.
I've actually created a museum exhibition that involved Pez containers once. Didn't know I'd have a chance to bring that up. That and the Zamboni. We've got a lot of words that have a Z in them here. Your point number seven, though, was look in all directions. I wonder if you could just for a moment say, how do you actually do that? So point number seven, look in all directions. You're an engineer. You're seeing to, among other things, the climate control inside a museum, the way you've just described it. And in order to solve problems like where to put the HVAC at the Renwick so that you do not have to raise the roof 10 feet up in the air and then be blamed forever for doing that. how do you do that? Do you literally, in actual practice, do you literally walk into the building and look all around? Do you look at drawings and imagine all around? How do you mean metaphorically look in all directions, or do you mean literally do it?
I think it's literally and then also metaphorically. And it's going all the way back to the 1860s drawings. What's fascinating is buildings 100 years ago were executed sometimes with only like five or six drawings. Now for a modern museum, we might have hundreds or thousands of drawing sheets that a contractor relies on. And we look at that history. We look at these historical records from the Library of Congress. We look at old photographs. We look at original drawings and the systems that were there, big heating system in the 1860s. But we also had the benefit of much more detailed drawings from the 1970 modernization. And they were a really good record of what was done, where all the ductwork was routed, where all the different spaces sat in terms of restrooms and stairwells. And I think we've gone to a very digital state in terms of how we think about buildings, but it doesn't completely substitute for getting one's hands dirty. So we walk through this entire building, especially the attic space where a lot of the systems ran, and wanted to make sure to understand the overall scale of things in a very direct way. Sometimes there's a limit to how much you can understand spatial conditions just through a computer model. And I know we now use more and more like virtual reality glasses to visualize things. But again, it's so much more incredible when you see not only the spaces behind the scenes, but then what is the public going to experience? What do we have to do so that public visiting experience doesn't change fundamentally because we did something super dramatic to the architecture of a historic building itself? I still remember at the time, maybe smartphones were still relatively new, but definitely the selfie stick was really novel still. But I attached my phone to a selfie stick and actually used that to take photos in very awkward conditions sitting on wooden planks in this attic space. And I still remember one of my colleagues was, "We're not here to take selfies of ourselves." And then I showed him how I was using it. "Oh, that's actually really smart. We should call it something else. Maybe not a selfie stick."
Hey, did you come up with a name?
I did it. Yeah, maybe okay. I should still. Maybe then I can sell it.
Okay. Listeners, please write in with a word for a selfie stick when it's reused, not to take pictures of self, but to take pictures of a site. Let's have a little sweepstakes.
Sounds good.
That is that idea, the thing you're talking about. For some, I don't know why I know this, but there's a rule in for truck drivers, which is called get out and look. G-O-A-L, goal. Get out and look. When you are backing up a long truck, which the geometry of backing up a truck is very curious.
Sure.
You have to steer the opposite way of how you're backing up, et cetera. And because you can't see around it, drivers are encouraged, sort of, they all know this. Any truck driver knows G-O-A-L, goal, get out and look. Stop the truck, go look, maybe with a selfie stick, depending on the situation, and then get back in the truck and steer accordingly. So I don't know why I know that, but that's kind of what you're talking about. You get out and look. You have to be, so your point number seven, when you look in all directions, go there and look in all actual directions in addition to doing it digitally. I think that's great. Right. That's awesome. Right. Otherwise, you won't know where to hide your HVAC.
That's right.
Okay, point number eight. This is a great point to end on. Point number eight is KISS, but the Roger Chang version is KISS. Keep it simple, sustainably. What's your take on that? Why did you change that last S?
Well, the original KISS was keep it simple, stupid. And I always thought that, that sounds a little bit too negative, because for the type of work we do, it does take a lot of smarts. It takes a lot of experience. It takes a lot of teamwork to do something like the Renwick Gallery or work on any sort of cultural institution type project. And so this notion of keep it simple, sustainably, goes back to this first point of 70 degrees and 50% relative humidity. Is what's the simplest way to maintain a good environment for people in a collection and do it for the long term? We've all seen that product we may be enamored with, we buy, and then if we don't take care of it, it quickly loses its function and is discarded. And unfortunately, we have a bit of a disposable society with a lot of objects and things right now, but we don't want to think that way when it comes to a museum and all the things that go into that museum and its collection. And so thinking longer term, that's about, can I maintain the system every single day for the next 50 years? Do I have the financial resources from visitorship, federal funding, whatever it may be, again, to be good stewards and not have to get in a situation where, well, maybe we have to get rid of this building or close it down. And then that ends up ultimately being a failure and an institution is not able to meet its mission. So I think keeping things simple is great. We definitely live in a world of a lot of complexity. And I'll be the first to admit that those HVAC systems have gone more and more complicated. They require a lot of sophisticated knowledge and fancy control systems to maintain these conditions. It's not that there's anything wrong with that. In some applications, you do need really good systems, but maybe not for an entire building and maybe not for every single institution.
Well, we started on HVAC. We ended on HVAC. Let's do a recap of the rest. This is our list for today with Roger Chang talking about some new ideas in museum climate control, some of them really new to me, super cool. Number one, why 70 degrees? Number two, does it have to be the premier system? Number three, reconsider those loan agreements. Number four, knitting at the Renwick. Number five, don't fight the building. Number six, fun puzzles. Number seven, look in all directions. And number eight, KISS, keep it simple, sustainably. Did we get everything? How'd we do?
We got everything.
We got everything. That's great. All right. Perfect. Well, Roger Chang, it has been great to have you on the show. Absolutely super. If listeners would like to get in touch with you, what is the best way for them to do that? Email, website, LinkedIn, someone's walking the dog, they want to email you right now. What's your email for people who are listening?
roger.chang@burohappel.com, roger.chang@burohappel.com.
Got it. And the website is what you would think from that. And LinkedIn, anything special about that? Or just look for you on LinkedIn and we'll find you.
Just look for me. I think you'll be able to find me.
All right. We'll put all that contact info and anything else you'd like in the show notes. And great. Okay. I think we covered it. Thank you, dear listener, for your time. In exchange, I hope this episode gave you some news you can use. If you would like to get in touch with me or you have an idea for the show, go to makingthemuseum.com and hit contact. You can also find me on LinkedIn under Jonathan Alger, A-L-G-E-R, or at the website of my firm, C&G Partners. By the way, like I mentioned, this podcast has an older sister. It's a one-minute newsletter under the same name, Making the Museum, One quick insight each time for museum leaders, exhibition teams, and visitor experience professionals. You can subscribe to that to come to your inbox at makingthemuseum.com. There's a big subscribe button in the menu at the top. Meanwhile, I'm Jonathan Elger, and I hope you'll join me next time for Making the Museum. Bye for now.